The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Give myself to you completely.
Good morning. It is Saturday at 10 a.m., and that means it's time for your weekly dose of Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and the purpose of this program is to take a brief break Saturday mornings from the doom spiral of our daily news feeds and the hustle and bustle of our human-centered lives, and to take a little time to celebrate and explore the rich natural world that's thriving all around us. We're very fortunate living here in this region to be surrounded with abundant access to clear rivers and forested mountains, and of course the Hudson River tidal estuary right along the banks here in Kingston, and all the diverse ecosystems and the biodiversity that these great places support. And I know that I am far from alone in finding that sometimes it can feel like my strongest tether to sanity these days comes from the time that I spend in nature. And so an important part of this show is highlighting the fact that nature is not some limited, distinct thing that's out there somewhere in the distance, but that we have to travel to experience. In fact, the natural world is all around us all the time because we are nature, and it wouldn't even be possible for us to leave nature if we wanted to. And so the wonders of the more than human world are always there waiting for us just to pay a little closer attention and slow down a little bit to see. So even here in the urban core of Midtown Kingston, there are always amazing organisms and fascinating ecological phenomenon unfolding all around us if we just slow down a little and take a look. And so not only here in this region are we fortunate to be surrounded by so much nature, we're also surrounded by an incredible network of academic institutions, conservation organizations, birding groups, natural history groups, and on and on. And so what we do with this show each week is we seek out guests to join us for an hour on the air and share their expertise in some corner of the natural world. And so we're up to about 60 episodes now, and every week is a different guest from scientists and professors to artists and authors. But the idea is always to have a conversation that can hopefully deepen our understanding and maybe even our affection with what's happening in the wild world that we may encounter when we step outside our front door. Because we know that people won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. So for longtime listeners, you'll know that for almost every episode we've had, we stay close to home and to a topic that is, you know, right here in front of us in the region, Hudson Valley or the Catskills. But today we're going to take a little bit of a journey, a couple of journeys actually, and invoke another extraordinary ecosystem near and dear to my heart. And so here today, with us live, we have an ambassador from the Klamath-Siskiyou ecoregion, bioregion of Southwest Oregon, Northwest California. So I want to welcome George Sexton, who is the conservation director of the Klamath-Siskiyou Wildland Center. Thank you for being with us here today, George.
Good morning, Laurel.
I wanted to bring you in and let folks know you were there as a teaser, and I will give a more proper introduction to George and his work shortly, but I am going to start today's show, as we do every week, with an opening segment called Who's About Town. And Who's About Town is sort of an ecological snapshot, just highlighting a few of the, things that are happening out in the natural world this time of year. And I actually, usually it's what happened the past week, but I actually took leave and we played music last week during this slot because I took advantage of the holiday weekend and went on a canoe camping adventure up in the Adirondacks. And so I wanted to highlight a couple cool things about that. First of all, it was just so neat to just drive 3 hours and be in such a different place. You know, the geology is different, the ecology, and just the vibe, you know, the species makeup of the forest. It really felt like we had gone to Canada and or left, you know, the ecoregion that we're in right here. And it was a very dramatic arrival. We arrived on this lake and got our canoe packed in the middle of a lightning storm that was, you know, pouring down rain and lightning crashing all around us, which then turned into the most extraordinary quadruple rainbow I'd ever seen. So it was a very kind of moody, dynamic time. And it was really neat being in such a different ecoregion up there, because so many of the species, from the trees to the flowers to the fish, were in many cases different than what I'm used to on a daily basis exploring down around here. But one really neat one that I have seen here, but only rarely, when, you know, wading into the shallow water, and we'd look down and see these sort of little opalescent flashes in the water, and reach down picking them up and realizing they were discarded shells from a freshwater mussel called the Eastern Elliptio. And I've never seen them in such abundance. You know, I once or twice have found them along the shore here on the Hudson, but they are a native, mussel, and they're a very good indicator of water quality because they are filter feeders. And so they're eating algae and bacteria and plankton. And so a lot of Eastern Elliptios and freshwater mussels means you're in some pretty good water. So that's a good sign. And then also they're very important because they can each mussel they've estimated can clean and filter about 10 gallons of water each day. So when you add that up by thousands of them, they actually can impact the water quality. And then, of course, they're great food for lots of forest critters, mammals and birds. They make for an easy prey. And so these guys are very interesting because obviously they are a bivalve, they're a mussel, and so they can't move around on their own. And so they've come up with a pretty ingenious way to distribute their young. And different species have different tactics, but basically the Eastern Elliptio mussel, they reproduce through open fertilization. So the males release their sperm into the water around them, and then the females take it in as they are bringing in water. So that's how the eggs become fertilized, and they take up to a month to develop into what are called glochidia, which is the larval stage of a freshwater mussel. But then if you're a little baby glochidia and you're living in a lake, how are you going to get somewhere else? How are you going to distribute around? And so the way they do this is they're able to attract host fish. And so different species have different host fish. And in the case of the Eastern Elliptio, which sounds like a Marvel supervillain, they actually have their host species include the American eel, yellow perch, brook trout, lake trout, and some different kinds of sculpin. And when the fish come by, they release this glochidia into the water, and it attaches itself to the gills of this fish, unbeknownst to the fish, as far as we know. And within a couple hours, that larvae becomes encapsulated in the host fish's body. And then it takes days or weeks, and those glochidia metamorphose into juvenile mussels, just about the size of a grain of sand. And at that point, they fall off the host and attach to the substrate. And once they do that, then those mussels can live for decades and reproduce. So a very interesting ecological interaction where something that looks like it might be inert, like a mussel, is actually doing some pretty active things in the water column. Okay, I also have to highlight the star of the show, of course, was the common loons. And I'm from the coast of California originally. I grew up knowing and loving loons, but to me, they have always been a bird of the ocean. And of course, I knew they went up to northern lakes in the summer. And for many folks born and raised in the Northeast, it's probably a taken for granted element of the summer landscape. But the absolute, never to be forgot experience of swimming out into the lake, being at eye level with these incredible birds as they yodel and sing, and they go back and forth from sounding like a kind of maniacal old lady being tickled to being, you know, a haunting howl like a wolf in the distance. And they make a lot of different sounds, really fascinating. And so they really do live this split life where in the summer, like we're seeing right now, two loons take over a section of lake and it's just the two of them, and they defend that territory and raise their babies. And then they are monogamous, these loons, but they don't travel together. So when it comes time after they've raised their babies, they take off and they'll fly thousands of miles away to the ocean, but not together. But then they will come back to the same part of the same lake and find each other again the next season, which is just a pretty incredible way to do it. And loons are super fascinating. If you have a bird book, or if you've looked through a bird field guide before, you'll notice that they're usually in a similar order. They start with a certain birds in the beginning, and then you end up with like the finches and the warblers at the end. And that's called phylogenetic order. And so usually a bird guide is oriented sort of in the evolutionary understanding of, so the oldest birds are in the front, and then the newest evolved birds are in the back. And you'll notice loons are one of the, you know, early pages, one of the first pages usually in a bird book. And so they're very old, and they sound like they are. And they're very, most birds have, you know, kind of hollow bones. It's actually more like a foamy matrix, but we call them hollow. But loons have solid bones. They're very, very heavy. And so this helps them, you know, sink under the water, where they are incredible predatory swimmers. And they can turn on a dime and go, you know, they outfish fish. They outswim fish in order to catch them. So very powerful divers. And it's really neat watching them do their peering behavior. So when they're out on the lake, they're swimming around on the surface, and then they just stick their head in the water, and then they look all around, and then when they see something that they, you know, to prey on, then whoop, they slip under and then go after it. But, you know, because they are, their feet are all the way back in the body, which makes them excellent swimmers, but it means they are almost useless on land. And so if they land sometimes on accident, like if there's a parking lot that's wet and the pavement might look like water, if they land there, they can't take off. They have to have a runway of many hundreds of yards of open water, sometimes up to a quarter mile, where they flap and flap and flap and then actually end up running to get that big heavy body off the water. So they're very specific. They have to have large, long legs. So really, really, really neat. And they're at the height of their breeding season right now. And it's so cool because they only lay one or two eggs. And then the babies, when they hatch, are immediately buoyant and they go out on the water. But they also can become waterlogged. And so the cutest thing a loon probably ever does is the mom, when she sees that happening, she lifts up her wing and then the babies climb on her back and then ride around on her back, which is a really beautiful thing to see. Well, I could talk forever about loons, but maybe I will move on. But I encourage folks to get up to some of the northern lakes. You know, they breed all over Canada, all over. We're just here in the Adirondacks. It's a very, very southern place that loons do this behavior. And also, I have to say, maybe the second to last for our Nature Nuggets today, because everyone, we have entered the peak mating season for everyone's favorite flirtatious little beetles. The fireflies are out in force. I was with some friends just last night down on the walkway on the shore of the, you know, near the Hutton Brickyards. And in all the years I've been on the East Coast, have never seen a display like last night. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of them, really mesmerizing. And I guess what I've read is that this is a result, because unfortunately, you know, in general, firefly species across the world are known to be in decline. But this year, all the wet that we've had, they're calling it sort of a dazzling comeback, because entomologists say that the soggy conditions of this wet spring and early summer are exactly what firefly larvae love, because they want rich, wet soil where they can eat snails and slugs and other tasty morsels. So they do well when there's a lot of rainfall. So, you know, even though the moon is full now, there is a period, you know, starting tonight, where we'll have, you know, an hour and then 2 hours over the next couple nights, but after the sun sets, before the moon rises, when it's really dark. So encourage you, even if it's just backyard here in Kingston, to make a point to get out and look at them, because they are so cool. And I read that there are over 2,400 species of fireflies in the world, with 120 in North America. So most of those are down in the tropics. But we have at least 40 species right here in New York State, which is something I think I certainly didn't realize, that there are dozens of different species. But if you're here in Kingston, you're probably seeing the Photinus Pyralis, which is the eastern firefly. And it's pretty incredible the way that they are able to do this. They're called photic organs to make their light. And so they actually combine three chemical substances in this specialized organ to produce the light. And so the substances are luciferin, which is a pigment, luciferase, which is an enzymatic catalyst, and ATP, which is a nucleotide that provides energy to cells. And so as they breathe in oxygen, they charge this reaction by regulating the amount of oxygen that they take in, and that's how they can modulate the flash that they produce. So, not grown up with them, I don't know that every time I see them, I just turn into a 9-year-old kid because it just seems so mesmerizing and remarkable. And so, unfortunately, fireflies have not been studied that much. For as beloved as they are, scientists really have just been focusing on them for the last few years. But we do know that they are in precipitous decline, and we know some of the reasons. And so scientists who advocate for fireflies have put out a list of steps that if you care about being future fireflies, there are some basic things that you can do. And one of them, of course, is to turn off your outside lights on summer nights, because that is obviously the way that they do what they do. And so those outside lights can really mess with them. Another thing you can do is to let your rotten logs and your leaf litter remain. So if there's parts of your backyard that you can just let be, please do. They also really like water features, if you have that in your area. And then, of course, maybe it's obvious, but obviously, please don't use pesticides. They found that lawn chemicals are especially harmful for fireflies. And if you do use fertilizers, using natural fertilizers is really important. And also read, interestingly, don't introduce earthworms. Earthworms are not native here. Any ones that we did have that are native are gone, and they can really interfere with the firefly larvae. Okay, we are going to wrap up this section, but the last thing I have to say, because it's just super intriguing and fascinating, is folks may have seen there's a story going viral where somebody's Nest Cam, their front porch camera, caught a ghostly glimpse this week of a giant cat in Rochester, New York, in the city, and the cat is clearly up to 3 feet tall. It's a ginormous cat, and very importantly, it has a very, very long tail. And so even though it's fleeting, it looks all the world to be a mountain lion, which of course shouldn't be here, but there it is. And so the Department of Environmental Conservation is doing a full investigation to try to see if somehow maybe this video was altered. But meanwhile, people across Rochester are now claiming to have seen, this cat. But of course, nobody has any scat or any fur or any direct evidence. But the video is there. The story to be continued, to see if we find out what is going on. Okay, I'm going to take this natural moment as a break to hear some words from our community.
Hi, I'm David Toman, Executive Director of the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater. We're a member-supported nonprofit working to protect the Hudson River through education, advocacy, sailing, and music. The iconic sloop sails from river communities along the Hudson from New York City to Rensselaer, including right here in Kingston. The best part of our work is sharing the Hudson River with communities, families, and students along the river. Join us for a public sale, attend a dockside program, book a private charter, or sponsor a community sale. Every trip is hands-on, inspiring experience that brings people closer to the river and to Clearwater's goal of a fishable, swimmable, drinkable Hudson. Our work depends on people like you who care about the river's future. Join the movement for a healthy Hudson and set sail for a good cause. To learn more or get involved, click Come Sailing at clearwater.org.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices.
Many voices.
Many voices.
One community.
Hi, this is Peter Wetzler from Sound Forms, Classical Music and Beyond. We're on Sunday afternoons from 2 to 4 p.m. here on Radio Kingston. Each week we travel through time with music from the Middle Ages and Renaissance through classical, romantic, and contemporary classical periods to new music that's happening today, both locally and around the world. We'll also feature live performances and conversations with composers and performers from our local Kingston area and beyond. That's Sound Forms, Classical Music and Beyond with me, Peter Wetzler, Sunday afternoons from 2 to 4 here at Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 1079, and anytime at radiokingston.org.
Midtown Kingston Arts District is hosting Summer Splash, a pop-up exhibition and networking event for artists at the Draw Gallery, beginning Friday, July 18th. This event is an opportunity for regional artists to meet and build relationships with one another, coinciding with the Friday of Upstate Art Weekend. There will also be food and beverages at the networking event. Visitors will also have the opportunity to view the Summer Splash exhibit, featuring 2D works made by artists in the MCAD community, from Friday, July 18th through Sunday, July 20th. The event is free and open to the public, but RSVPs are kindly requested in order to get a proper headcount. Summer Splash, networking event, Friday, July 18th from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Exhibition open from Friday through Sunday, July 20th at the Draw Gallery, 24 Iwo Jima Lane in Kingston. To RSVP and for more information, visit mkad.art. Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland. And today we are bringing in our guest, George Sexton. George is calling in from the hamlet of Talent, Oregon, in Southern Oregon. And George is the conservation director of a bioregional conservation organization called the Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands Center, known as KS Wild. Welcome, George. Thank you for being here again.
Thank you for having me.
George has a JD, a certificate in natural resources and environmental law from Lewis and Clark Law School. He also holds a BA in political science from Reed College. And he has worked to protect forests and watersheds in the Pacific Northwest for the last 30 years. And his efforts have ended the old growth logging program on several national forests, as well as establishing Ninth Circuit case law protecting late successional reserves from salvage logging. And we'll explore what those words mean in a minute. And he's also facilitated small diameter fuels projects and prescribed burning on hundreds of thousands of acres. And full disclosure, I have been working with George for many of those 30 years in these issues. And so he's a colleague and a hero of mine, and I'm delighted to have you here, George. I wanted to start off and, you know, maybe just asking you to set a little context. You know, you, more than most people I've known, have dedicated your career and your life to advocating and defending the landscape that you love. And I'm hoping you could share a little bit about your life path that inspired you to commit to this role that you play.
Sure thing. So I grew up in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains in Western Oregon. And when I was born in 1970, those mountains were largely defined by old growth forests and rivers and streams that were chock-a-block with steelhead and salmon. And by the time I was 10, those forests had been unraveled by rampant clear cutting, and the salmon and steelhead populations had crashed. So my childhood was a front row seat to the deforestation of the Cascade Mountain Range and the conversion of old growth forest ecosystems on public lands into second growth timber plantations that resemble a farm crop. At the time, the timber industry was the be-all and end-all of the Oregon economy and politics. And so it seemed inevitable. There wasn't an alternative or any resistance to what was occurring, or even a knowledge that one could resist. But it did not sit right, particularly the crash of the salmon and steelhead populations just seemed catastrophic. So I went into the National Park Service and was a park ranger in the San Juan Islands, right on the Washington Canada border. And I was listening to the radio one morning, and there was an old growth timber sale happening that was impacting First Nations lands. And there was a direct action road blockade occurring that was trying to halt that logging or at least slow it down. And the radio interviewer, like yourself, asked two young sisters, very young, what they thought they could accomplish by blockading the road, because they were not going to stop the logging and they would be arrested and their action was symbolic but pointless. And the answer was that they said that someone listening to our voices right now is going to answer the call, is going to stand up. And I was like, hey, I hear you. I'm answering the call. You know, so that was the moment for me. I was like, I hear the call. There's someone else out there that cares about these issues. I'm there. I'll be right there. So I immediately went up to Clackamas Sound like the next day. And that was the path.
Wow. That is an incredibly compelling origin story. I would love to see that those young women could hear that themselves. I wonder, that would be pretty amazing. Well, wow, thank you for that. And I'm wondering, you know, I'm guessing for many of our listeners, this might be the first time that they're hearing the term Klamath Siskiyou. And so, you know, I think we have a lot of wonderful and famous ecosystems from Yellowstone to Yosemite around the world. But for various reasons, the Klamath Siskiyou may not be so well known. And so I'm wondering if you could help just give folks a quick orientation to where and what is the Klamath Siskiyou bioregion.
Klamath Siskiyous are a series of mountains in southwest Oregon and northwest California, and they encompass about 8 million acres of public lands, primarily Forest Service, but also Bureau of Land Management. So that 8 million acres of mountainous terrain belongs to every American. They are part of your heritage, whether you ever visit the area or not. And one of the things that's unique about the area is that most of those mountains were not formed through volcanism, through volcanoes. Instead, they were formed through plate tectonics and geological uplift, such that those mountains were once the seafloor. And so the soils and geology of the area are much different than most of the West Coast or most of North America. And that has led to a different evolutionary path for much of the flora and fauna of the area. It's all because of its steepness and remoteness. It also has escaped the much of the logging rampage that wiped out many of the West Coast forests in the 70s through the early 90s. And so for the lower 48 states, there are relatively intact roadless areas, large wildlands, and old growth forests. Now we're getting our lunch eaten by climate change right now.
Yeah.
And so those ecosystems are changing and being impacted at a rate that I would never have foreseen happen, you know, in my lifetime, including with stand replacing fire is a huge issue for us. So it's not a static ecosystem. Things are very much in flux right now. And the hope is that because of the number of habitat niches and elevational bands and the various aspects that the mountains have, that they can form kind of a climate refugia where species can both migrate to ecological niches that they can inhabit in a warming climate and have the availability of habitat niches to inhabit.
There's so many amazing things that you said. I want to dig into a couple. And one is, you know, well, fire. I think there's there's a number of fundamental things that, you know, people from the East Coast, you know, wouldn't find familiar about the West Coast forest, and fire being obviously huge among them. And I know, you know, for millions of people across the East Coast, their first experience with, well, the smoke from, you know, the Canadian wildfires, but then actually even some fires that we had around here just happened. And so there's a lot of terms like red flag warning and air quality index and things that have been first time people have heard them many times, you know, it was the last, you know, couple of years, whereas these are very familiar to anyone living in the West. But I wanted to ask you to say a little more, because fires, obviously, they're terrifying and destructive, but also it's much more complicated than that, right? And the ecosystems of the Klamath Siskiyou are born in fire and have a deep relationship. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit more to that ecological role of fire and kind of how we got to where we are.
I'll do my best. That's a big topic.
Sure, in the nutshell version.
And so, yes, the forests and ecosystems of Southwest Oregon and Northwest California evolved under fire and would not be as diverse as they are or as resilient as they are without fire. And the indigenous peoples of the region for millennia utilized prescribed fire as a way of managing forests to reduce fuels and to increase things like acorn production. After white settlement, the policy of the federal government was to suppress all fires, and that was called a fire exclusion policy. And so for about 100 years, we had Smokey Bear, only you, right? And so the idea was no more fire. And that combined with rampant logging changed the composition of the forests such that you have more fuels, more small trees, and less big fire-resilient trees. Add in climate change to the cocktail, and now we have longer, hotter summers in addition to the increased fuel loading and the different cereal and species composition in the forests. And so there is a race going on, and the race is, can forest restoration practitioners get in there and do restoration to address the effects of 100 years of fire suppression and get fire back onto the landscape in a way that doesn't completely remove the forest, or will stand replacing fire get there first and remove most of the ecosystem components of those old growth forests? That's kind of the race we're in right now. I remember back in the 90s, there was a large forest fire in the Western Cascades outside of the town of Eugene. And it was sort of a seminal moment in the Northwest Forest Plan Forest Wars. This was, there's been a fire, will the old growth forest now be clear cut, or will it be allowed to come back naturally? And at that time, a naturally recovering post-fire old growth ecosystem was the rarest ecosystem on the West Coast, because the timber industry on private lands, the state on state lands, the federal government on federal lands, all had the same policy of, once a forest burns, we're going to clear cut it and convert it into a timber plantation. That reality has completely shifted now. Now, one of the most common ecosystems on the West Coast is forests that have been burned.
Wow.
And yeah. And so what was once a very rare and niche ecosystem now defines the vast majority, but certainly the majority of forests on the west slope of the Cascades, such that there are more stand replacing old growth forests that have experienced fire than there are old growth forests still standing.
Wow. I had never heard it put like that. That's amazing. And yeah, and I just want to underline, because, you know, I mentioned the term salvage logging in your bio, and that, of course, is the practice you're describing, where they quote unquote salvage, you know, a burned forest. And, you know, I think there can be intuition there, like, oh, well, it's burned, they look dead, you know, might as well get the timber out. But in fact, I know from your work that, you know, old growth forests are the most resilient, you know, to ecosystem, you know, to fire, and that it's the young ones and the plantations that go up in smoke. And so, yeah, thank you for your central role in bringing about that transformation that you just mentioned. Well, I wanted to also, so, you know, you mentioned, well, public lands, and I know that, so if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Nature Nuggets, and we're talking with George Sexton. George is the conservation director of the Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands Center, based in the Klamath Siskiyou, in Southwest Oregon, Northwest California. And, you know, one fundamental difference, I think you said 8 million acres of public lands that KS Wild is sort of a watchdog group for. And we do have, you know, we have the Catskills, we have the Adirondacks here, and those are amazingly protected, you know, some of it forever wild in the New York State Constitution. But of course, that's state, and it's a bit unusual. And what you're talking about are federal lands. And so I just wanted to really underscore, these are, yeah, commonly held by the American people. So even if you live in New York, they are equally as much, you know, part of the natural legacy that, you know, of yours than being local. And yet, they aren't just being preserved for the benefit of all people. There's some problems. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that watchdog process that you do, you know, about when a threat arises, you know, how does it come across your desk? And then, you know, how have you had so much success with the tactics you've used on public lands?
Well, I tell you, it's a shifting landscape as we speak. And so the things that have been true in the past are likely not going to be true going forward under this administration. Sure. And in this environment. Traditionally, there has been a bedrock environmental law called the National Environmental Policy Act, which mandates that when federal agencies propose management practices for public lands, that there is a scientific review process that the agency goes through to disclose what the environmental effects will be, and B, a public commenting process so that the public can weigh in on the management of their public lands. Both of those things are likely not to be true going forward. What it looks like is going to happen under the current administration is that all timber sale and mining and grazing activities on public lands are likely to be conducted through a more secret process called a categorical exclusion, such that there isn't a scientific review and there isn't a public process. The other thing that is rapidly shifting is that for the majority of the history of the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, those agencies were funded such that they had the capacity to manage lands. And in many small communities, the Forest Service office and the post office were the hub of those communities, even if there was no library, you know, or no market. You might still have a Forest Service district office and a post office. The federal government is abandoning those rural communities and is firing and humiliating the federal workers who manage public lands, and trying to push as many of them out of public land management as possible. And it's not hard to see where this is going, which is continued attempts to privatize the public lands that belong to all of us. And so the threats that KS Wild has dealt with in the past to public lands are very different than the ones that we're likely to be dealing with in the future. in the past, we were dealing with large federal agencies who were well-funded to try and manage public lands, in many cases for the benefit of corporations that benefited from the extraction of resources from those public lands, the timber industry, the mining industry, the grazing industry. Now those federal land management agencies have been gutted, both financially and through their workforce. And the idea is, I think, to simply liquidate those public lands and to get the federal government out of the business of having public lands that belong to all Americans.
Well, the picture you're painting is quite distressing, but it has been fascinating just over the last few weeks to watch this sort of unlikely alliance happen, because they did try to force a massive sell-off of public lands, through the big, terrible bill, and watching a lot of conservative, hunter groups and Western state conservative organizations sort of really join forces and give a strong pushback to that was at least heartening, that it seems like there is a it's one of the few bipartisan kind of across the, spectrum, alliances that I've seen since, in the last couple of years. So I don't know. Yeah. So at least it was averted for now.
And to speak to that, that was not a one-off.
Yeah.
And that was a shot across the bow. And the in many ways, the mass firings and the defunding of the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management are to accomplish that end, And it's not just the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. The Park Service has been gutted. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been gutted. And so the ability of the federal government to manage public lands has been eviscerated. And so we're in an untenable situation right now. We already touched on the fire issue, but there are fewer firefighters now by far than there were a year ago. And there are fewer people available to do forest restoration work and to increase the resiliency of forests and ecosystems and to protect homes and communities in the wildland urban interface than there were a year ago.
Yeah.
And if that trend continues, we should expect privatization of public lands to be presented as the solution to the intentional crisis of eliminating public land managers from public lands.
Well, and interesting, because something you've touched on there is the narrative, building and, creating a narrative that then makes something seem logical that people wouldn't have accepted before. And I wanted to maybe use that as a segue to ask you to talk to. So, the one thing that I say, every single episode, and I saw you smile, was that, people won't fight for what they don't love and they can't love what they don't know. And that's a bit of a riff off of years ago, K.S. Wilde coming up. We came up with the "Love Where You Live, Defend What You Love" is sort of one of the stickers that folks at K.S. Wilde use. And I think that that's sort of a universal, inspiring a sense of place and a sense of like identity that then inspires people to stand in defense of the values of that place is something that is universal, whether you're here in the Hudson Valley or whether you're in the Klamath Siskiyou. And I guess I would just be interested in, hearing you speak to or reflect on, kind of that role. A lot of what you do is, deep in legal ease or technical, stuff. But also, you've been a powerful agent in inspiring people to get outside and to understand where they live better and to, take responsibility for it. And so, I just, would love to hear you, especially given so many of the tools that we may have relied on in the past, maybe kind of going away for at least for now. to speak a little bit to that, the importance of that outreach, community cultivation.
Well, if you've ever walked in an old growth forest, it's impossible not to be inspired by the ecological experience you have and the emotional experience you have and the aesthetic experience that you have. And it's like nothing else in the world. You know, the towering trees, the incredible biodiversity, the bird song, the quality of the light, all of it it's something that humans need. And it speaks for itself. And so the mountains and the rivers of the Klamath Siskiyous are some of the American natural gems that have not been converted into just commerce. You know, there's still nature there with the capital N. And when people go camping or go on a hike or go birding or go hunting or go out on their off-road vehicles, they get to have an experience on public lands that they are a part of and an owner of that is an experience that exists for almost no other country on the planet. You're an owner of those lands, and you are a part of the ecosystem of which those mountains are the basis. And so the thing we have going for us, regardless of what the rules are for public lands management or who's in power or what the economics of it are, is that these places are beloved and they're worthy of love. And so the resistance and the work to defend them will go on regardless of the politics or the challenges that we face. It's just integral to, I think, the culture and the history and the future of Southwest Oregon and Northwest California, that Americans love these mountains and love these rivers and are going to try and step up for them the best they can.
Thank you for that. Much appreciated. Before I move on to other topics, I think this is a natural spot to take a final break to hear another couple minutes of words from the community.
Hi, I'm Harv Hillowitz from the Global Center for Social Entrepreneurs Network, or GSEN. We assist U.S. military veterans to become more independent and prosperous. Unfortunately, our vets are some of the most underserved folks in the USA, suffering disproportionate amounts of unemployment, underemployment, homelessness, discrimination, and suicide. The federal government is now cutting VA programs drastically. GSEN is right here in Kingston, and we have exclusive programs just for veterans to become oriented to starting their own business ventures or nonprofits. If you or someone you know is a U.S. military veteran in need, or if you would like to help or sponsor a vet, call 845-590-0925 or find the Global Center for Social Entrepreneurs Network at gcsen.org. Thank you.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices, one community.
It's music.
Hi, I'm Annie Nero. Join me Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m. for Annie's Theme.
It's music.
Each week, we'll come up with a musical theme. It could be anything at all, a theme loosely related to something going on here in Kingston. We'll stretch that theme so far that it's unrecognizable, but the theme will always be there.
It's music.
Like a jazz improvisation that goes so far out but returns to its standard melody. There's no genre of music, just a theme. Annie's Theme.
It's music.
Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m. here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 107.9, and anytime at radiokingston.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Nature Nuggets on Radio Kingston. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and I want to remind folks that if you've just caught a part of this conversation this morning and you want to hear the whole thing, the full episode will be archived by tomorrow at radiokingston.org, and that's the case with all of our 60-plus episodes. You can scroll through and see all kinds of different topics from the small to the large that you can choose to listen to. We also are having a presence on Instagram. We're at HV Nature Nuggets if you want to follow us there. And if you want to contact the show directly to suggest a guest or to ask a burning question about the natural world, you can reach out to us at naturenuggets@radiokingston.org. And lastly, actually, we are freshly up on the platforms for podcasts. So Spotify, Apple, and other places. You can also go back and find or share old episodes. So we are talking today with George Sexton. He's the conservation director of the Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands Center. The Klamath Siskiyou is an extraordinary bioregion in southwest Oregon and northwest California. And, you know, we've just got a handful of minutes left on the show, but I wanted to ask you maybe to speak to a couple. You know, there's a lot of threats and challenges and darkness in the political wind that's blowing at the moment. But there are also some really incredibly inspiring developments that have happened that I don't know that I ever thought I would see in my life as a lover of the Klamath Siskiyou. And first, I wanted to talk about the wolves. I mean, I can picture more than 20 years ago, I don't know, sitting around the fire and talking to you about, you know, one time hearing, you know, the howl of the wolf in the distance. And we thought of it, at least I did, you know, in the future generations that would happen. And yet here we are, right? So I'd love you to hear just a little bit about the return of the wolves and what your experience has been with that.
Yeah, the return of the wolves. So wolves were extirpated from Oregon, you know, through hunting and trapping to facilitate livestock grazing. And it was thought that there could be a reintroduction effort and to return that keystone species to the ecosystem. And it was unclear when that would occur, how successful it would be, how much it would cost, who would do it. So the wolves took matters into their own hands. And a wolf by the romantic name of OR-37 swam across the Columbia River and traversed through the Cascade Mountains and came down to the Klamath Siskiyous and said, "I'm home." And when a wolf does that, it makes it more likely for other wolves to follow through a process that we're not completely sure how it works. But so sure enough, OR-37 was followed, and against all odds, we were certain that OR-37, that wolf, would either be hit by a car or shot, or would never find a mate. Instead, OR-37 was the beachhead and came to the Klamath Siskiyous, and another wolf followed, and they mated and formed a pack. And now there are self-sustaining and well-established wolf populations, you know, throughout Northern California and Southern Oregon. And the wolves have returned and the howls are back. That is not just great for wolves in and of themselves, but there's a very interesting study out of Yellowstone called The Ecology of Fear, which talks about how the presence of wolves increases the health of riparian vegetation, because ungulates no longer just stand right by the creek all day eating the creekside vegetation. Instead, they gotta stay on the move because the wolf is there, right? So the ripple effects of the return of the wolf for riparian health and ecosystem health in general are manifest, and they're occurring, and it's a wonderful thing.
Well, yeah, thank you for sharing that. It feels like such an important, besides the fact that they're just such a mythological creature, they're also an ecological cornerstone, and also just such a strong reminder of the resilience of the natural world. If we stop doing the destruction, you know, nature will rebound, which seems like a very encouraging message right now. And sometimes we can be very direct in that process. So the last story I'm hoping I can get you to refer to is, you know, the Klamath Siskiyous are defined by two major rivers, the Klamath River and the Rogue River. And the Klamath River for decades has had a major fight about these giant series of dams, which just became one of the most incredible conservation success stories I've ever known. And given, I know we only have 5 minutes left and this could be a whole episode just on this, but if you could maybe speak to that for just a few minutes, George.
Sure. There are several indigenous nations on the lower Klamath River that are salmon tribes, in particular the Karuk tribe and the Yurok tribe. And their cultures have been really harmed by the crash of the salmon populations. In many years, they're not allowed to harvest any fish because there are so few fish left in the Klamath River system. As recently as the 1950s, the Klamath River was considered one of the premier steelhead fisheries in the world. And fish runs have suffered tremendously. And one of the primary causes of that, not the sole cause, but one of the primary ones, is the damming of the upper Klamath River, which affects the river flow and the river temperature. And so those dams were up for relicensing, and they could not come into compliance with either the Clean Water Act or the Endangered Species Act. And they would have been extremely expensive to refit. They were not contributing to renewable energy. They're primarily, for irrigation diversion. And so there was a tribal-led effort to take out the lower three Klamath River dams and restore the river sites for fish habitat. And that, against all odds, occurred. And now salmon are returning and spawning in their ancestral spawning grounds that used to be a reservoir and are once again rivers and tributary creeks. So it was a tribal-led effort. Conservation groups were along for the ride and were supportive of it, but it was the indigenous First Nations people who did the work and got the restoration to occur.
Yeah, thank you. And I would encourage folks to, Google or look for some imagery, because the Yurok, in addition to, getting the dams removed, they spent years collecting native seeds and growing small trees. And so there's been a massive replanting effort in the scar kind of left behind, and so instead of letting the star thistle and the invasive, grasses take over, they had tons of students out planting by hand, they were dropping seeds by helicopters, and now those native plants are starting to take hold. And so the before and after photos are just absolutely stunning. And now I believe it's become the biggest land back. Tens of thousands of acres were given by to the tribes by the state of California. I believe that's associated with that. I wanted to end on a couple notes of conservation success stories, because sometimes it takes a long time, but you use the term against all odds more than once, and that is your specialty, big victories against all odds. Well, George, I want to say thank you so much for the work you do. I've been a forest activist for all of my life, over 30 years, and I think it's fair to say that there are more acres of standing old growth forests on our public lands due to you as an individual than to any other person that I've ever come across in the movement. And so that is a wonderful legacy to be leaving behind. And thank you so much for continuing the good fight and for coming on the air with us today.
Thank you for the kind words, Laurel.
Take care, George.
Completely on high.
The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY.